Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. Jeff Fawcett and I come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health and the environment.
As I'm sure you know, the center aisles of the grocery store is where processed foods are staged and where food has the highest markup, the highest profit for the least food value. We've caught on. And because of that, as today's guest tells us, a worried food industry refers to that area of the grocery store as the morgue, because people are staying away in increasing numbers. That's because we're learning that there's a better way to eat. In his article, Why the Food Movement is Unstoppable, my guest, Jonathan Latham, argues that it's not just about better eating. The food movement, he says, could be the missing vehicle for transformative social change. Jonathan Latham, PhD, is co-founder and executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project and editor of the Independent Science News website. Dr. Latham holds a master's degree in crop genetics and a PhD in virology. He was subsequently a postdoctoral research associate in the Department of Genetics, University of Wisconsin, Madison. He has published scientific papers in disciplines as diverse as plant ecology, plant virology, genetics, and crop genetic engineering. Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. Thanks for joining us, Jonathan.
Hi there, Jeffrey.
I am very much enamored of your article. And just so we can orient the listeners, tell us very briefly, who, in your view, is the food movement?
So, well, you know, I wrote this article a couple of months ago, and you know, because I was struck, you know, one of the beginning, you know, starting points for me was I was struck by the fact that many people were calling the food movement elitist, and I didn't consider it to be elitist. I know people personally, and you know, that I read about in all different social classes who are in the food movement. You know, I have Prince Charles, and there are rappers, and there are, you know, people reclaiming their lives in Detroit and places like Cleveland, and there are peasants. And so I was struck by how incredibly diverse the food movement was as a social movement. And so, you know, that was sort of the starting point for this article, was, you know, how can a social movement be composed of people with such, you know, in many ways, diverse interests?
From your standpoint, it sounds like, and from the body of your article, that this is more or less self-identified of who is and who is not in the food movement, that you have a fairly big tent that includes who is in. So folks listening to the program are probably already in the food movement, even if they don't know that they're think of themselves as being part of the food movement. So that neighborhood gardens, urban gardens, that's part of the food movement. Now, in your view, what have been the things, the achievements of the food movement thus far that lend themselves to being an unstoppable movement?
Well, you know, I don't see their achievements as being any way defining of how far they've come. But I think there are some very interesting, you know, markers that the food movement has laid down. You know, basically, one of the interesting fights over the summer was over GMO labeling in Congress. And the food movement came incredibly close to getting definitive food labeling enacted in the United States. And this is something that would have been inconceivable about 3 years ago. And, you know, they've narrowly lost elections in ballot propositions in California, in Oregon, and in Washington. But all of those in the face of incredibly large sums of money spent by Coca-Cola and Monsanto and Nestle and some of these humongous companies that, you know, essentially have a conceit of us having pretty much, you know, unstoppable power of their own. And so, you know, for an organization or for a movement rather that you know it's not really organized around any big nonprofits, for example. They're not really represented particularly adequately by any of the sort of well-known nonprofits that whose names people will be familiar with, like the you know Greenpeace or the NRDC or the World Wildlife Fund or whatever. So despite you know not having that institutional support, they have you know basically come within a whisker of getting GMO labeling enacted in Congress, and only basically you know when the Vermont law was preempted by Congress on the, around the 15th of July. It was basically to nix a law that had been passed in Vermont, which in itself was a victory for the food movement. And so, you know, there were some last minute backroom dealings in Congress that basically were needed to basically bring some Democratic senators onto the side of Monsanto that, you know, essentially those people would not have been very happy being on that side. And so, you know, incredible shenanigans were required in Washington to basically defeat the food movement. And as I said, it's a very diverse and on the surface, not well organized group of individuals. And so that's a, you know, a political moment, if you like, that was instructive to me.
Now, to what extent are various elements of the food movement, because in your article you have quite a list of different kinds of entities that are objectively part of the food movement. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing an increasing cooperation, synergy, working together between these elements so that, for instance, you just mentioned anti-GMO forces, but then there is also, for instance, urban gardening, and then there's you know, a wide variety of other kinds of movements that are mm-hmm. part of this. To what extent are they coming together?
Well, I mean, I would say in quite important ways they're coming together. You know, one of those is the movement to basically keep control of seeds. So, for example, mm-hmm. there have been various moves around the world and also within the U.S. to, for example, criminalize seed sharing, and for farmers to criminalize seed saving. And these are essentially criminalizing, these moves are criminalizing people, very diverse people, you know, industrial farmers, peasants in developing countries, and also home gardeners or people who want to breed seeds for you know future use or for their own hobbies. And so those people are basically unified against companies like Monsanto that basically are attempting to control the seed industry for the reason that they want to control agriculture. And they see that as a revenue point. And so between those aims of Monsanto, they are basically aimed squarely at many activities that many people in many parts of society see as traditional activities taking place in the food system. So those people come together and oppose, you know, essentially one or a few companies and some quite consistent policies being introduced by neoliberal governments in different parts of the world, from India to the U.S. to Europe to South America or Africa. So there are many, many alliances that are being formed around the food movement in which people are basically seeing common cause. And, you know, we can go even wider than those things. For example, we can talk about people who are interested in animal welfare making alliances with people who are interested in healthy eating and people who are interested in small and family farms and local foods. You know, if you're interested in animal welfare or better tasting food, then you in many ways have common cause with all those other groups. And so those people, you know, people in each of those groups that in the past thought of themselves as separate now realize because of, you know, the noise and the the sort of media interest and the social media interest of the food movement, that they actually have so much in common that they should work together. And sometimes you see that, and they come to conferences together, for example, and discuss issues.
And on that very topic, you, as I noted, and as you write in your paper, that the food movement could very well be what you call the missing vehicle for transformative social change. Of what does transformative social change consist in your view? That is kind of the next formative step with regard to the food movement.
Well, you know, we normally think of social change as something that happens through the political process, for example. But the problem with the political process is that almost all the agents within it essentially subscribe to, you know, what are neoliberal philosophies, what are essentially reductionist philosophies, what are essentially Enlightenment philosophies. And the problem with subscribing to these philosophies is that they are part of the problem, right? So if you see the world, for example, as connected in, or disconnected rather, from, you know, one problem disconnected from another problem, then you know, you can be part of the conventional political process, and you can try to solve climate change by building more windmills, or you could try to solve democracy by enfranchising more people, or you could try to solve problems of for instance, separation between cities and the countryside. You can solve those with a bunch of very specific solutions that are likely to be technologically oriented, for example. And what the food movement does is it basically takes all those problems and it says these problems are all part of a bigger problem, and they are the connections. The bigger problem is that we're disconnected from the planet in the sense that our food is coming from the planet, and we are producing it in such a way as to destroy the waterways, to destroy the coral reefs, to destroy the rainforest, to destroy human health, to destroy our connectedness to each other through the food system, for example. And there is a food system potentially that could evolve from the rubble, if you like, of the food system that we already have that could solve many, many of these problems, including things like democracy, right? So democracy has been conceived at many points over history as being based in ownership of land. So Thomas Jefferson, for example, imagined, you know, yeoman-type landowners being the basically the bulwark of democracy, in the sense that if you have a job, if you work in a modern economy, and you essentially can have difficulty your democratic rights because you don't own land. And what this is observed in the civil rights era, for example. So black farmers who lived in counties where they had better access to land, or there were more black farmers, tended to be more politically active. And the reason they were more politically active is because, and more successful in getting what they wanted, is because, you know, they couldn't be, if they agitated on behalf of their civil rights, they couldn't be fired by someone because they lived on a farm and they owned their own land, and so they could feed themselves and house themselves. Right? And so basically people who didn't like their social activist stance had no way of fighting back against them. So there are deep connections between land ownership, for example, and democracy. And we can, you know, if we had a farming system which was local, if we had a farming system which is more distributed, which is more based on family farms, we would have a more secure foundation for our democratic process than we currently do. And so these are the kinds of solutions that the food movement is coming up with on a on a routine basis as a way to get ourselves away from dependence on money and politics, for example, and a way to get ourselves away from dependence on big corporations and their domination of the food system and of political life.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Jeff Fawcett. I'm interviewing Jonathan Latham today on his article, Why the Food Movement is Unstoppable. So on that, to continue that thought, what you're really talking about is a food movement that consists of elements which initially may be focused on individual aspects of the food political economy, but ultimately combines to see common purpose in a number of elements in food production, food distribution, and so on, but then moves on to even a broader view of informing other social change movements. I've been reading the literature on the transition movement of how to essentially decentralize and localize how people support themselves and how to connect back to have a sense of place. How do you see the food movement informing not necessarily what identifies itself as the transition movement, but those kinds of movements that are more traditionally political. I'm thinking of worker cooperatives, those sorts of movements.
Well, the relationship that I perceive between the more traditional political movements and the food movement is, in a sense, one of disconnection at this present time. I mean, you see labor movements, for example, seemingly having very little in common with the food movement. You know, they tend to be quite urban. And, you know, I argue in the article that there are elements of urban activity of the food movement. You know, people reclaiming their food deserts, people reclaiming land to grow food because they can't afford to do otherwise, and so forth. But at the same time, the traditional labor movement has few or even maybe no connections with the food movement at the moment. And there's an opportunity there for a synergy in the sense that, you know, many people in the food movement, although I argue it's a movement of social change, many people in the food movement don't see themselves as agents of social change. They see themselves as people who buy organic food or people who want to rid themselves of an illness that they have, or as people who have, are interested in localism or animal rights and so forth. And they don't see themselves as politically motivated. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you have people, for example, in the union movement and labor rights movement or who are interested in civil rights, who don't really see their connections with the food movement. And there is an opportunity for all these groups in many ways to unify, but only around the food movement is my thesis. You know, the unifying concept is food and agriculture. The unifying concept is not unionism or civil rights necessarily, because the significance of the food movement is that it's biological in nature. And so it is a very big tent, as you suggested earlier, under which union organizing could also happen, or around which civil rights organizing could also happen. But it's difficult to see the process the other way around. And so it's taken the arrival of the food movement to provide an opportunity for these groups to organize in synergy with each other, which in many times they haven't done. And so I think that at the moment the connections are pretty weak between unions and the food movement, for example, or between socialists and the food movement, or even people on the right, for example, libertarians, who also have many aims in common of social independence and so forth that could be served by the food movement too. But what those people need to think about is how the food movement fits in with their goals. You know, the traditional view, political view of food and agriculture is that it's at the bottom of the heap. You know, we use peasants as a term of abuse, for example. And, you know, whereas the food movement can understand the value of peasant agriculture and peasant way of life and living on the farm and on the land and self-sufficiency and so forth, we, you know, the traditional working class or middle class take a negative view of how where agriculture fits in our political system, for example. So, you know, when I was doing my PhD, I used to study tomatoes and potatoes and so forth, and people would make fun, you know, of my research, in my topics of research, because, you know, these are subjects of gardening and horticulture and so forth. You know, these are considered lowly pursuits. Whereas nowadays, people don't think the same way about that kind of research. You know, they understand, for example, the power of biotechnology, but also the benefits of healthy eating and opportunities for you know, livelihoods in the horticulture industry, for example. So the situation is changing in a big way, and to my mind, for the better. But these connections are still, in many ways, being worked out.
One of the questions that I wanted to make sure that I got to was in saying mm-hmm. that the food movement is unstoppable. Mm-hmm. With clarify that for me with respect to what is it unstoppable, since we're in this realm of what
you know. What's interesting
change.
To me is that, as I mentioned in the article, the food movement, for example, it doesn't really have leaders. You know, lots of people independently have come together and identified such a thing as a food movement, but you know, the only leadership really that the food movement obviously has is, for example, people like Michael Pollan or Jose Bove, or they're basically individuals who've done impressive or remarkable or popular things that have enabled them to be sort of celebrities, if you like, of the food movement. But these people are not leading the food movement as an institution. You know, there are no institutions really that represent the food movement. You know, there are some organizations like Slow Food, for example, but these are quite small relative to the scale of the whole food movement. And so you have basically a sort of mindset that is developing, which is based on, as I said, a different philosophy of the Enlightenment, and that basically, in my opinion, overthrows a large proportion of the thinking that got us to the state we are in now of ecological degradation and disconnectedness from each other and so forth. And the food movement has an opportunity and is the vehicle to put that right. Right? So it understands, for example, that the true nature of biological organisms has to do with synergy, right? So the Enlightenment narrative is that the true nature of biological organisms is competitive and basically antagonistic. You know, we compete with other animals for the limited supply of food there is. We compete with each other for the limited supply of food or resources or money or whatever it is. And that's considered to be the natural order of the biological world. And the food movement sees things very differently, right? It turns waste into useful products, and it sees synergies all over the food system, for example. You know, so you can take waste and turn it into compost. You can take fields and you can grow, by growing diverse crops, you can have much more productive ecosystems, for example. And so the food movement basically sees all these synergies between organisms and between people, And it sees what can be made of those. And that is a fundamentally revolutionary mindset that the food movement has. And so, you know, it's that idea, you know, is the way I put it in the article, is a kind of an extension of Barry Commoner type environmentalism of the 1970s, but it takes it more to its logical conclusion that, you know, to grow healthy animals, you have to look after them. You don't torture them and keep them in boxes or whatever. You have an opportunity to synergize agriculture in such a way that you can have healthy animals and better tasting food and a more productive agro ecosystem as a consequence of certain methods of farming that are unavailable to people who are using chemicals or who have a sort of competitive mindset with the animals that they're growing on their farm. And so this concept of synergy, for example, it overthrows the whole Darwinian ethos that in many ways the Enlightenment and their economy are built around. And if you carry all these ideas to their legitimate conclusion, logical conclusion, what you end up with is the idea of a farm and a social system based around farms that can solve the tremendous problems that we have today. So it can solve climate change, and it can solve the food shortages. It can solve democratic problems. It can solve social problems. It can solve ecological problems. We can, you know, put right the river supply. We can restore water supplies to people and so forth. So the food system has, an agricultural system has the potential to do all these things, but only if you think about it as a system of synergies. And in order to think about it as a system of synergies, then basically what you're doing is in a sense, overthrowing the social order.
Good thought. In reading your article and listening to you describe the details of it, the concept that comes to my mind is self-organizing systems. Mm-hmm. The food movement, particularly since some elements are of it may not be self-consciously members of the food movement, nonetheless contribute to it. And on the more the word that's coming into my mind is advanced, but that's not exactly what I intend. Is that system of the food movement and what it is as it grows, it reaches out to other aspects just as it of necessity would, because it becomes a living system in the literal sense. It's not an abstract movement to create the minimum wage and so on, but a movement that has its focus on an essential aspect of people's lives and organizes itself around that. That, to me, is one of the things that's at the heart of your argument.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't really touched on that yet, but I basically that is what I, you know, what I argue is
let's pause there, because we're going to have to take a musical break and continue with this. After we have a little music. So this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Jeff Fawcett. I'm talking today with Jonathan Latham about why the food movement is unstoppable. We'll take about a minute break for some music, and we'll be right back. Hold on. Welcome back to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. I'm talking today with Jonathan Latham about his article, Why the Food Movement is Unstoppable. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for a free stream of this week's show, information on over 600 past shows, and access to show recordings using our library card feature. To contact us, send email to admin, at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Jonathan, do you have information, contact information for people to find out about your work?
Yes, we actually have two websites. So one is called independentsciencenews.org, and the other one is the Bioscience Resource Project, which is the nonprofit that I'm a co-founder of with my colleague Allison Wilson.
And people who are interested in keeping up with your work can subscribe to your newsletter on the independentsciencenews.org website. Yeah?
Yeah, they should try to sign up to the mailing list. That's right, and they won't get too much information, but hopefully the information that they will get will be good.
Well, that's how I got the notice of your article. Well, all of your articles, all the things that get posted to that site.
Yeah, that's right.
It's terrific. So to return back to our conversation, I had just gotten excited about. How your argument suggests how we're seeing self-organizing systems in the way that the food movement itself potentially comes together, and how it affects other movements, social justice movements, environmental movements, and so on. So, and you had some thoughts on that. So, if you could.
Yep. So. So, you know, your description of it as a self-organizing system is, I didn't use those words in the article, but I think they would be good ones, because what happens at a political level in the food movement, as I said, there is, you know, there aren't really the professional or NGO type organizations who really lead the food movement. What there are is, groups of people on, for example, social media or who get together for campaigns and so forth that move the goals of the food movement or the ideas of the food movement forward. And what these people, what you see them doing is taking the tools that they have at hand and using them. You know, maybe they only have social media, maybe they have an email group, maybe they have their buying power in the food system. But what people do is they get together, and they, because many of the needs of the food movement are quite simple, it provides a relatively easy way for people acting sort of semi-independently to achieve their goals, you know. So basically, with simple tools, you can achieve simple goals, like, for example, getting companies to remove additives from their food products. And, you know, you've got several things going on here. One is that the companies are public-facing companies. They are reasonably sensitive, unlike many politicians, for example. They are reasonably sensitive to the opinions of their customers. So if they see their customers demanding non-GMO or organic or cleaner foods or more ethical foods, or to take, you know, the customers want the antibiotics taken out of their meats, for example, the consumers and the people in the food system have the tools at their disposal to make those kinds of changes happen. And what I was arguing was that people, you know, they reach for the tool that is most useful to them. And this is social change that is not that is basically happening outside of organizations. Like, you know, if you imagine how Greenpeace has historically worked, or 350.org has historically worked, or the civil rights era, you know, the basically people had to be told what to do by a command and control system. You know, today we're going to campaign on this issue, and we're going to do it in this particular way, and so forth, and we're going to take the bus and go to this particular town or whatever. This is social organizing in a spontaneous way, right? So the food movement is operating in a completely different way, but it's also operating in a very effective way. And as you say, politically, it's a self-organizing system, and it's almost invisible, you know, on the outside, but the effect of it is very real. You know, people sharing information, people contacting companies and making real differences to the food system.
One of the things that I found interesting personally in your article was the revival of the Grange movement, which just because of reading of history, knew about its role in politics of the progressive era, and then faded out, and my recollection of it was that since my people come from Iowa and are farming stock, that the Grange was something my grandparents went to, you know, and it was kind of a social club, and they'd go and hang out and whatnot. But apparently it is reviving itself as what its original kind of impetus was, which is social media of the old kind, which is people having a potluck and talking to one another. So it's even down to that kind of, I would be embarrassed to call it a technology, but it's a form of communication. So and the Grange, although focused on farm issues, which was the core of what concerned people in those communities, became part of a political force with the progressive party and populist movement generally, I would envision that kind of thing becomes more, even though it is one of those odd institutions that it is very decentralized kind of organization. And similarly throughout, yeah, as you say, it's people. There's a movement afoot having to do with taking back local control of how people can battle back against protect their rights to protect themselves from corporate actions and whatnot. By doing local control and fighting back what is often one of the major impediments, which is existing government institutions, state, federal, and local, and figuring out how to pursue their interests in the most profound sense of the word. So this... There's a lot. The food movement is, I guess my point is, the food movement isn't the only place where this is going on. And so there's opportunity for synergism across, you know, food movement with other movements, local control kinds of movements, as well as within the food movement itself.
I mean, I would argue that I would place the Grange within the food movement, you know, because it's about agricultural, you know. Go on.
Oh, no, I'm agreeing with you that it is definitely within the food movement, but it suddenly becomes, as I said, that the purpose of it, when I was growing up in the 50s, my grandparents would regularly go to Grange meetings. And they were social clubs, and that's kind of how I thought of them. And not until I got into college did I think of Grange as a potentially political movement. That's what it was about. And that as a social club, people are talking about more than the price of corn or what the weather is going to be like next spring, or varieties of crops to plant, or what have you, that other things get discussed. And that seems to me at least one of the ways in which the food movement moves out beyond itself and informs other movements.
I would say that the revival of the Grange movement, you know, there's a synergistic thing going on that the Grange is suited to the food movement and the food movement is suited to the Grange, you know, and so you've had branches of the Grange reviving seemingly pretty much independently of each other in quite a few parts of the country.
Yep.
And it's one of those, you know, straws in the wind, if you like, that tells you that something is up.
Yes. Well, it seems to reinforce the idea of this self-organizing system, because they don't just fall out of the sky. They organize themselves in response to environmental cues, call it. One of the things that I would like to ask you about to speculate on is with the if the as the food movement advances, how do you see that that different food political economy affecting different other production processes, distribution process, technological development, scientific development? These much broader kinds of areas which seem out of the control of you know people who just want to have a nice meal or not part. It certainly affects their ability to have a nice meal, even though they aren't actually thinking about it necessarily. So what happens to the biotech industry? What happens to supermarkets as an institution? What happens to things like patents on biology and so on?
Yeah. I mean, these are difficult questions to answer for the most part. You know, I think there is a sense in which the food movement, you know, my prediction is the food movement will be very transformative. And that means that all the cogs in our whole social order will change places and, you know, some cogs will become more important and some cogs will become smaller. And a lot of changes, interconnected changes will happen, you know, from people leaving the cities to political changes to technological changes to, you know, to people, you know, will go back to the land, for example, and they will find themselves more at home there. And, you know, we may end up with a repopulated countryside, and that will have certain ramifications for, you know, people wanting to use cell phones or the internet and so forth. But at the same time, people will become more decentralized, you know, would be a prediction, right? So we would end up with a less centralized, less hierarchical society. And at the same time, the, you know, for example, how that will affect supermarkets or how that will affect the biotech industry is, you know, this movement is coalescing in the face of those, you know, in the sense of considering those institutions to be threats to people. You know, the biotech industry is a threat to people because it may harm people because of the side effects of genetic engineering, but also supermarkets threaten people because of the contaminated meat and so forth that they sell and the poor job opportunities that they offer. You know, the food movement is partly about equality. It's partly about people not really wanting the cheapest kind of food and not needing to buy the cheapest kind of food because there will be more distributed wealth, for example. So I think the changes will be very complicated, but I believe that they will be basically wholly positive. You know, these are not the kind of changes where there's a trade-off where one group has to lose and another group, in order for another group to have to win, you know, which is how our economy has been changing over the last 150 years. But it will be a much more regularly beneficial set of changes that will occur. These are my expectations.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. I'm talking today with Jonathan Latham about his article "Why the Food Movement is Unstoppable." Before we have to part, I would like you to talk. Some we've been talking in cheery tones about the food movement and its astonishing potential. What threatens it, or who threatens it?
Yep. Well, you know, as I've suggested, it is a transformative opportunity, and so you know there are industries, for example, the fossil fuel industry. Is threatened by the food industry, you know, the threatened by the food movement rather, because you know if you look back in history, what happened with the Green Revolution is that the Green Revolution was not formed around the idea that we need to help these hungry people to feed themselves and to feed the world and so forth. The Green Revolution was formed by the Rockefeller Foundation, which was basically representing oil and chemical interests. Right? The Rockefeller Foundation started the Green Revolution in Mexico in the late 1940s, early 1950s, because they wanted to sell more oil and more chemicals. Right? That was the fundamental thing. And so you need oil to make fertilizer, you need chemicals for pesticides and so forth. So the Green Revolution was this package, and you know, it was sold in a sense around the seeds, but really what it was resources. And so these the Rockefeller Foundation was basically doing social engineering of society to build markets. So these institutions, you know, these exact same institutions, the chemical industry, the fossil fuel industry, they will suffer greatly if the aims of the food movement, you know, end up being in organic production systems and local food and so forth. You know, we have an economy based on local interactions. So there will be major threats to that to the food movement. I think we can predict that. And so the question is, what form will those take? And if you look at the historical efforts that were made, for example, you know, all the way from defeating communism in the West to defeating the civil rights movement and Martin Luther King and defeating feminism, for example, you know, in the 1970s, the FBI saw feminism as a huge threat to the social order. And so they spent a lot of time undermining activist feminists and sort of growing the grassroots of a sort of watered-down version of feminism that you see with Hillary Clinton nowadays. Right? So basically, Me Too, you know, I want to break the glass ceiling, and it's not socially inclusive and so forth. And so they, you know, these social movements, and including unions, you know, unions have been infiltrated by the FBI and the CIA. So all these social movements have been undermined by the forces that be, especially in the United States, but also in other, you know, in other countries too. You know, the elites, the neoliberal, and the wealthy and the Rockefeller type people, they have spent a huge amount of money and put a huge amount of thought into undermining these social movements. And so I think that we can anticipate that they will try to do the same thing with social movements today. And so, for, you know, a classic example of this is, you know, Slow Food USA is one of the biggest food movement organizations in the country, and they had a very outspoken leader who they got rid of in about a year ago, and 1 week later they got $1 million grant from the Kellogg Foundation. Right? And this mirrors exactly what happened, for example, with the civil rights movement. So the civil rights movement, the people like the Ford Foundation were funding watered-down versions of civil rights, right, to create a counterforce to Martin Luther King and his plans to expand civil rights into bigger issues like anti-war and social justice issues. And so they, you know, they basically, the funding of watered down versions of the food movement is something that we can anticipate happening and is already underway, so far as I can tell. You know, watered down versions of the anti-GMO movement and so forth, these all exist in small forms. And so you know, people have to be really on their guard and to think about whether social organizers who they come across are really interested in big picture social change and the kind of thing that would bring justice to all people, or whether they're pursuing narrow goals that essentially will siphon off people's energy into doing unproductive tasks, because that is the kind of organizations that elites like to fund because they see that bigger social movements could be a threat to them.
Before he got into politics, that was Barack Obama's job in Chicago. And there were lots of folks before his election talked about that he was a peacemaker between opposing political forces as opposed to a social justice advocate. Certainly one of the more interesting things that I've heard discussed in the wake of the recent election is that one of the things people who want to, I don't even know what to call what they like being called these days, whether we're on the left, we used to be on the left, and then we became progressives, and then we became, you know, all sorts of stuff. But people who want to see positive change happen, that they need grassroots organizing. That is the crying need. You know, we don't need another plan. We don't need another book. We need people. You know, that's what you do. You figure out how to pay people to organize other people. As I mentioned, this local rights movement takes root, takes off at the point where all the existing systems fail them. People have to figure out how to protect themselves. There's one big name that came to my mind when you were talking about the Rockefellers and the Green Revolution, which is Monsanto and their ownership of seeds and so on. But where I was headed with this is wondering, can you think of an example of how members of the food movement or a food movement group element successfully fought those kinds of encroachments, that kind of squashing of the movement?
Well, I mean the, you know, a real obvious choice from the areas that I know of best are the anti-GMO movements in Europe. You know, basically, they have brought those big companies to a standstill. You know, a relatively small number of people, they have, you know, by basically pursuing a very broad and very radical agenda, they have prevented those companies from basically really growing any GMOs in Europe. And very few people in Europe are eating GMOs. Most of them are hardly exposed at all. There is some animal feed that's coming from South America, for example, that is feeding animals in Europe. But basically, you know, it's very instructive to look at the campaign that those people fought, because, you know, at the beginning of those campaigns, established environmental organizations basically decided that, you know, you can't stop Monsanto. You can't fight Bayer. You can't fight, you know, City Hall in a sense. And those people basically, you know, the institutions basically gave up on the idea of being anti-GMO. But there were activists in Britain and other parts of Europe who decided that this is a battle that was worth fighting. And they could see that they had the social support of a significant proportion of the population. And basically, by not compromising on any of their goals, for example, they could have, think about the compromises they could have made. They could have argued, for example, that we would accept some GMOs, but not others, right? And that would have enabled the companies to create a wedge around their movement and basically drive holes in it. And what the anti-GMO movement basically said is, we don't care what kind of GMOs you're going to bring towards us, we're going to reject a lot of them. And so, for example, that makes them very different from people who have campaigned against pesticides. People who have campaigned against pesticides have basically, you know, they've run campaigns against glyphosate, or they've run campaigns against chlorpyrifos or against DDT and so forth. And they've basically fought pesticides one at a time, which has basically allowed the companies to every time that a pesticide does get banned because of health or environmental effects, that they bring forward a new one. And the companies have been basically unable to do that in the case of GMOs, because people on the ground who are self-organizing and for the most part completely independent of major nonprofits have basically refused to accept any GMOs. And that has been a huge food movement success. You know, it's exceeded any environmental any environmental victories that I can think of.
We're getting close to being out of time, but before you go, I would like you to talk to our listeners some about how they can support the food movement.
Well, you know, I'm an information type person, right? I believe activism is includes things like sharing information and developing your understanding. And, you know, the information that I like to share with people is the connectedness of the food movement. You know, if you think of food and agriculture as being connected to the climate and connected to your health and connected to the health of waterways and the food system to the health of rainforests, basically all these problems that we see in our society, a huge proportion of them can be solved by fixing the food system. And so, you know, the big argument that the companies have against fixing the food system is that organic or local production systems cannot feed the world. And so one huge idea is to share with people is to tell them that, and to tell your friends that basically the organic and agroecological and non-industrial system can easily feed the world. And there's no problem whatsoever with doing that. And the number one argument of the biotech industry and the pesticide industry is basically bogus. You know, they don't have any evidence that other systems can't feed the world. And what's really happening is that those industrial systems are basically destroying our agricultural land in the process of growing the food that they do. And so there's a whole bunch of ideas that can be shared, and many of them are on our website. But it's incredibly important that people share these ideas so that it will help the food movement to grow.
So please give us your websites one more time.
So there's independentsciencenews.org and the Bioscience Resource Project. Bioscience Resource Project is more for, you know, it's more of a technical research resource, rather.
And we'll have those links on our website. Jonathan Latham, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey.
You've been listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out, for easier extended access to our over 600 archive shows with our library card feature, a free stream of this week's show, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. If you want to reach us, please do so by email, admin, @yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett and Lena Berman. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.